Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA, LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, July 23rd, 2005. Our focus today is on Latin America, economics, trade, and the growing true democracy movement. In our first hour, we'll hear from Sean Donahue, freelance journalist and Witness for Peace delegation leader, on his recent trip to Nicaragua. He focuses on effects of world and U.S. economic policies on the country. Our second hour will feature Arnie Alpert, coordinator of the New Hampshire American Friends Service Committee on the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA. Following that, we'll have a down-to-earth interview with Charlie Reed, New Hampshire organic farmer. We'll also bring you music, people's history, announcements, and more. So stay tuned. First, for some news. From the Boston Globe, study cites seeds of terror in Iraq. War radicalized most, probes find. New investigations by the Saudi Arabian government and an Israeli think tank, both of which painstakingly analyzed the backgrounds and motivations of hundreds of foreigners entering Iraq to fight the United States, have found that the vast majority of these foreign fighters are not former terrorists and became radicalized by the war itself. The studies, which together constitute the most detailed picture available of foreign fighters, cast serious doubt on President Bush's claim that those responsible for some of the worst violence are terrorists who seized on the opportunity to make Iraq the central front in a battle against the United States. The terrorists know that the outcome in Iraq will leave them emboldened or defeated, Bush said in his nationally televised address on the war at Fort Bragg in North Carolina last month. So they are waging a campaign of murder and destruction. The U.S. military is fighting the terrorists in Iraq, he repeated this month, so we do not have to face them here at home. However, interrogations of nearly 300 Saudis captured while trying to sneak into Iraq and case studies of more than three dozen others who blew themselves up in suicide attacks show that most were heeding the calls from clerics and activists to drive infidels out of Arab land, according to a study by Saudi investigator Nawaf Obaid, a U.S.-trained analyst who was commissioned by the Saudi government and given access to Saudi officials and intelligence. A separate Israeli analysis of 154 foreign fighters, compiled by a leading terrorism researcher, found that despite the presence of some senior al-Qaeda operatives who are organizing the volunteers, the vast majority of non-Iraqi Arabs killed in Iraq have never taken part in any terrorist activity prior to their arrival in Iraq. American intelligence officials, speaking on the condition of anonymity, and terrorism specialists, paint a similar portrait of the suicide bombers wreaking havoc in Iraq. Prior to the Iraq War, they were not Islamic extremists seeking to attack the United States, as al-Qaeda did 4 years ago, but are part of a new generation responding to calls to defend their fellow Muslims from crusaders and infidels. Peter Bergen, a terrorism specialist at the nonpartisan New America Foundation, a Washington think tank, said, "The president is right that Iraq is a main front in the war on terrorism, but this is a front we created." Foreign militants make up only a small percentage of the insurgents fighting in Iraq, as little as 10%, according to U.S. military and intelligence officials. But the impact of the foreign fighters has been enormous. Obaid said in an interview from London that his Saudi study found that the largest group is young kids who saw the images of the war on TV and are reading the stuff on the internet, or they see a name of a cousin on the list or a guy who belongs to their tribe and they feel a responsibility to go. Other fighters who are coming from Iraq from across the Middle East and North Africa are older, in their late 20s or 30s, and have families, according to the two investigations. The vast majority of them had nothing to do with al-Qaeda before September 11th and have nothing to do with al-Qaeda today, said Reuven Paz, author of the Israeli study, I am not sure the American public is really aware of the enormous influence of the war in Iraq, not just on Islamists, but the entire Arab world. Case studies of foreign fighters indicated they considered the Iraq war an attack on the Muslim region and Arab culture, Paz said. For example, while the attacks of September 11, 2001 were largely condemned by clerics as violations of Muslim law, many religious leaders in Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations have promulgated fatwas or religious edicts saying that waging jihad in Iraq is justified by the Quran because it is defensive in nature. Last October, 26 clerics in Saudi Arabia said it was the duty of every Muslim to go and fight in Iraq. One indication that a heightened degree of Arab solidarity is a leading factor is that they are almost entirely Arabs and not Muslims from other countries, such as those who volunteered to fight in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Chechnya. To say we must fight them in Baghdad so we don't have to fight them in Boston implies there is a finite number of people, and if you pen them up in Iraq, you can kill them all, said Bergen. The truth is, we increased the pool by what we did in Iraq. The CIA's National Intelligence Council concluded in a report earlier this year that Iraq and other possible conflicts in the future could provide recruitment, training grounds, technical skills, and language proficiency for a new class of terrorists who are professionalized and for whom political violence becomes an end in itself. Back WTO or farm subsidies go on, U.S. tells Africa. From Reuters. The United States has told African nations they must await a global trade deal before Washington will cut farm export subsidies, warning that failure at WTO talks in December could see subsidies extended for years. A meeting in Senegal's capital, Dakar, with the 37 countries eligible for trade perks under Washington's African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, has offered U.S. trade chiefs a chance to explain to African counterparts G8 commitments made earlier this month to end farm export subsidies damaging African farmers. African officials have said they will press for a timetable, but U.S. Agriculture Secretary Mike Johanns told them not to expect one until other rich countries agreed to dismantle their subsidies too in World Trade Organization talks in Hong Kong in December, under the so-called Doha round of negotiations. Johanns urged African countries to work with Washington's negotiators to ensure a deal at the Hong Kong talks, which will bring together ministers from all 148 WTO member states. The WTO's Doha round, due to be completed by the end of 2006, virtually collapsed after talks in Mexico in 2003 failed to reach a deal on subsidies, with poor countries refusing to accept concessions they said would damage their economies. Johanns said a U.S. proposal to end cotton export subsidies was proof of Washington's commitment to end subsidies blamed by some for keeping African farmers in poverty. Washington missed a July 1st WTO deadline to end cotton export subsidies, but President Bush has asked Congress to eliminate them as part of a budget legislation to be considered in September. And now a press release from the Pastors for Peace, a group which many of you may have seen speak in Portsmouth a couple of weeks ago. Pastors for Peace caravan to Cuba crosses the border, a near-total victory. Pastors for Peace claimed a huge victory as a tired but excited group of 130 citizens crossed the U.S.-Mexican border just before daybreak on July 22nd, with almost all of the 140 tons of humanitarian aid en route to Cuba and collected by the Pastors for Peace Friend Shipment Cuba Caravan. Their struggle to send on the remaining computers, which had been either confiscated or restricted by U.S. authorities, to Cuban children with special needs, is building momentum. The caravan is composed of 7 brightly painted yellow school buses, 2 box trucks, and several smaller vehicles, all of them loaded with humanitarian aid for Cuba. On Thursday, more than 40 U.S. Customs officers, acting on the instructions of Commerce Department officials, detained the caravan at the border and began a search of their vehicles, one item at a time. In an exhaustive 6-hour search of the first two yellow school buses, officials confiscated all of the computers and computer equipment available. 11 computers, 3 monitors, 2 printers, 2 scanners, and a variety of computer parts and accessories. Officials then threatened to tow the remaining vehicles carrying the rest of the aid. Meanwhile, members of the caravan walked aid across the border and demonstrated beside the marooned buses. Our caravans have delivered nearly 2,500 tons of aid to Cuba since 1992, all of it without asking permission of the U.S. government. But this year, something changed. We have heard that government officials at the highest level made a special determination that this year our Pastors for Peace caravan would not pass, said Reverend Walker. We've already proven them wrong. 95% of our caravan has crossed into Mexico and is headed toward Cuba. Now we're determined to get our computers to Cuba as well. Reverend Lucius Walker, executive director of the IFCO/Pastors for Peace, continued, "Our extraordinary group of committed and hard-working volunteers worked through the night to make sure that our caravan of urgently needed medical supplies and hurricane relief makes it to Cuba on time. More than ever, we are committed to making sure that all the supplies donated by generous U.S. citizens will get to the Cuban people." The campaign to free the computers has received tremendous support from Capitol Hill and from members of the Pastors for Peace grassroots network nationwide, who are calling on the Commerce Department to demand the release of the Pastors for Peace computers for Cuba and an end to the inhumane blockade. Here's a song for you, written by Silvio Rodriguez and performed by Charlie King and Karen Brandaugh. The song is called Pequina Serenata Diurna. Charlie and Karen describe it as Silvio's love song for Cuba. Translated, "I live in a free country that can only be free on this planet at this moment in time. I want to ask forgiveness of those who died to make my freedom possible."
Vivo en un país libre, cual solamente puede ser libre. En esta tierra, en este instante, soy feliz porque soy gigante. Amo una mujer clara que amo y me ama sin perder nada. Oh, casi nada, que no es lo mismo, pero es igual. Y si esto fuera poco, tengo mis cantos que poco a poco vuelvo y rehago a mitad del tiempo. Como le cuadra un hombre despierto, soy feliz, soy un hombre feliz y quiero que me perdonen por este día los muertos de mi felicidad. Soy feliz, soy un hombre feliz y quiero que me perdonen por este día los muertos de
This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. Today, I'm talking with Sean Donahue, longtime activist, freelance journalist, poet, and former director of New Hampshire Peace Action. Sean has gone on numerous Witness for Peace delegations to Colombia and most recently to Nicaragua. Sean returned from Nicaragua in mid-June and is here to talk with us about his experiences. Thanks for coming in, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this recent trip. Can you tell us who was on the delegation and what the purpose was?
We had people of all ages from all different walks of life from around the U.S. And basically, we were in Nicaragua to look at the impacts of U.S. economic policies on the poor, both in urban and rural areas.
And what did you see and experience?
Experienced tremendous poverty and tremendous despair in Nicaragua. It's really quite devastating to see a country that just two decades ago succeeded in a revolution to overthrow a dictatorship and went through a period of so much hope in which people really believed they could begin to take control of their own destinies and transform their country. But now, two decades later, after suffering first a decade of terrorist war waged by the U.S. through its proxy army, the Contras, and now a decade and a half of economic war waged by the U.S. through the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, people are in a situation of complete desperation. Farmers are losing their land because they can't get adequate credit for the technology and the seeds they need. People who are forced off their land have to go to the cities, compete for the handful of jobs that exist at sweatshops where hours are long and conditions are harsh. And those who can't find work in the sweatshops find themselves baking on the streets, prostituting themselves, living in the dump, picking garbage to recycle it and sell it, and just in a position in which they have no access to even the most basic services and no way to meet even their most basic needs.
I understand that according to the United Nations Development Program, 79.9% of the population in Nicaragua lives on less than $2 a day, and that many in the country have no access to electricity, water they can drink, health care, education. Could we go back to the question of why is Nicaragua so poor?
Nicaragua has been faced with tremendous difficulties, mostly imposed by the outside world. At the outset, you have Nicaragua having survived 10 years of terrorist war, in which the Contras, funded by the U.S., attacked villages, mined the harbors of Nicaragua, waged an all-out war that divided the country and devastated it. Coming out of that war, a U.S.-backed government, the government of Violeta Chamorro, began taking loans from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to try to fund the reconstruction of the country. Those loans came at a terrible price. Agreements that forced the government to slash funding for health care, for education, for water services, basically denying those most basic services to the poorest people. At the same time, the global economy was changing, and the structures of the markets for coffee and for grain and for other crops being grown in Nicaragua was changing. A lot more cheap goods were being dumped on the market, prices were falling, farmers were losing their land, being forced into the cities, and some forced abroad. Now reached a point where Nicaragua's primary source of income is actually people working in Costa Rica and the U.S. sending money back to Nicaragua, where people who were surviving in rural poverty, where they could at least have water to drink and food to eat, are now struggling to stay alive in the cities where they don't have access to food. A situation where the healthcare system is in complete disarray. The public clinics, their idea of sanitizing instruments is washing them with soap and water. Inadequately trained staff perform surgeries. People wait for hours and hours. And if you are prescribed medication, then often the cost of the medication will cost a month's wages. And so it's completely out of reach. Education is increasingly out of the reach of the poorest people. Many have to send their children to work in order to feed the families. And for those who want to send their children to school, cuts in education spending have meant they now have to pay for the paper, for the pens, for the books, for the maintenance of the school, sometimes even for part of the teachers' salaries. And so most families can't afford to spend what amounts to up to a month's wages in order to send a child to school. And so now illiteracy rates are climbing, and that's dooming the future of Nicaragua, really limiting what kind of economic development can happen down the road.
You spoke about the United States' proxy war on Nicaragua. What interest does the United States have in Nicaragua? I think most people will remember the Iran-Contra war. I don't know that as many people are aware of the Contra piece of that. I wonder if you could tell us a little more.
Sure. There are a couple of things going on. The first was what Noam Chomsky describes as a threat of a good example. In Nicaragua, the Sandinistas, a popular movement made up mainly of workers and campesinos with very little formal military training who took up arms, managed to overthrow a U.S.-backed military dictator and his well-trained army, and began to establish a government that tried to implement a form of democratic socialism, really a new experiment for Latin America. And there was a danger in neighboring countries like El Salvador and Guatemala that people seeing this example would then believe in the possibility of liberation and the U.S. would begin to lose control of the region. Secondly, Nicaragua is very strategically placed in terms of the movement of goods. It's long been seen as a place where dry routes as alternatives to the Panama Canal could be put through. Thirdly, at the time there was the Cold War paranoia and the idea that anybody who talked about justice for the poor, anybody who talked about workers and farmers controlling their own destiny, was part of the Soviet plot for world domination. And so that was used to justify funding what really amounted to a terrorist war against Nicaragua. We armed and trained militias that waged a war against the civilian population. In many cases, people who were targeted by the Contras included people who were working on development projects, on rural electrification, on water projects. In many communities, the Contras would go in looking for the teenage volunteers who had come as part of a literacy campaign in order to teach poor campesinos how to read. Over a decade, the combination of this terrorist war and an economic embargo ended up crushing Nicaragua. Eventually, the people voted the Sandinista government out of power because they wanted an end to the embargo, they wanted an end to the war, and the U.S. told them that the only way out was to change their government and put in somebody the U.S. could support.
I understand that the United States was actually condemned by the International Criminal Court for their involvement in Nicaragua in the 1980s.
In 1987, in an unprecedented ruling, the International Criminal Court found the U.S. responsible for the mining of Nicaragua's harbors and ordered the U.S. to pay $7.8 billion in reparations. It's ironic today we talk about Nicaragua owing a debt to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank. That debt that Nicaragua supposedly owes is $5.6 billion. Even if we were to assume no interest accruing on the payments the U.S. hasn't made, they're ordered by the International Criminal Court. That debt pales in comparison to the U.S. debt to Nicaragua.
Which I find very interesting. I think there is a real mindset of Central America, South America, being poor and needy and needing our help, and that we're their knights in shining armor. It sort of puts it in a different perspective to see that actually our debt to Nicaragua is larger than their debt to us or to world financial institutions.
In fact, that's only counting the findings the courts have already made. Many in Latin America are now talking about a new concept, the concept of ecological debt. The idea that developing countries that have gone in and looted the resources, polluted the waters and land of poor countries, should bear some responsibility for the cost of restoring what was taken and what was lost. Nicaragua is a perfect example of this. Lake Managua, the city the capital is built on, was a dumping ground for U.S. corporations for decades under the Somoza dictatorship. The lake is filled with battery acid that a U.S. company poured into the water. In fact, on the shores of that lake now is one of the largest dumps in Nicaragua, and also a neighborhood where some of the poorest of the poor live, Aqualinca, ironically in the language of the indigenous people of the region, meant sunflower. And it's the place where the oldest footprints in the Americas were left. But today that land is contaminated with battery acid that was dumped there up through the 1970s. People are drinking poison water, eating poison fruit that was grown on that land.
So in this context, what about the debt relief spoken of at the G8 meetings and by the powerful nations of the world? Do you see that as a positive development, as a way to begin paying back a debt, as well as forgiving a debt?
Debt relief is really a cruel hoax on many levels. To begin with, the debts that we're supposedly forgiving are debts that everybody knew Nicaragua would never be capable of paying. The G8 powers have stated out front that one of the purposes of forgiving the debt is so the country will be in position to borrow more money. It's kind of like when you run up a lot of money on your credit card, the credit card companies all want to give you more credit cards so you can go deeper in debt and be deeper into their control. But it gets more insidious than that. Conditions of the loans that Nicaragua has given over the years have gone by various names. Initially, they were called structural adjustment programs. Eventually, that became unpopular, and they became poverty reduction programs. Basically, these were agreements that forced Nicaragua to slash social spending, to put what money it was able to save into paying off its internal debt, which is mostly owned to private banks, mostly owned by the Pérez family, which owns most of Nicaragua, and to privatize public resources and public services. And so this has devastated Nicaragua. The privatization of electricity has already been a complete disaster. The Spanish company bought the electric company for less than it was worth, never delivered the electricity it promised to rural regions that don't have it, and it increased rates and brought about declines in services in addition to laying off tremendous numbers of unionized public sector workers. More seriously than that, we've seen severe cuts in health care and in education. And that has really limited the future possibilities of Nicaragua. When you have a population that's illiterate, when you have a population that can't get basic health care, you have a population that can't really benefit from economic development. Fernando Cardenal, the Jesuit priest who led the great literacy campaign of the 1980s, says that you can't have economic development without human development. It's like building a house without a foundation, it will fall. That's exactly what this model is for Nicaragua. The idea is that somehow this debt forgiveness will bring economic development, somehow will bring the possibility for factories to come in to the country. But with a workforce that isn't educated, that isn't prepared to really reap the benefits of economic development, that's not going to do anything. We've seen a complete reversal of the gains that were made in the 80s. In the early 80s, in a matter of less than 2 years, the Sandinistas were able to bring the literacy rate up from around 50% to around 80%. Already now, the literacy rate has dropped into the low 70s, heading for the 60s. No sign of turning around. We're witnessing a complete reversal of all the gains that were made. So basically, under this debt relief plan, Nicaragua will still have to meet the same kinds of conditions that it was forced to meet under the earlier loans. It will have to cut public spending. It will be under increased pressure to privatize public services. It will have to put more and more of its money into servicing its internal debt. And so that money is never going to reach the poorest of the poor. It's never going to bring about any of the real human development that's necessary to make an economic development happen. Sociologists and economists in Nicaragua say that even more than the debt, it's been these conditions that have caused the increasing gap between rich and poor in Nicaragua. It's been these conditions that have completely dismantled the social services in Nicaragua. And it's these conditions that will continue to keep the poor down.
So while the debt will be gone, the conditions that lead to the debt and even more to the poverty are actually going to be reinforced?
Absolutely. In fact, we're hearing from people who've been working in the public sector and people in the social movements and in the churches that we may actually see pressures getting worse. That because most of the companies who have economic interests in the privatization of resources like water in Nicaragua are European companies, Nicaragua is going to have a moral and political debt, in a sense, to Europe for this debt forgiveness. There will be increased pressure to grant concessions to those companies. We also know there's going to be increased pressure to pay off the internal debt. Most of the internal debt is owed to a couple of private banks in Nicaragua. The families that own those banks are also the families that have economic interests in privatization. So there's going to be increasing pressure to privatize public services, which in the past, what's happened in Nicaragua, has meant decline in the quality of services, massive layoffs, and increases in rates that consumers pay.
Sean, do you have any idea if this is typical? You know, are these the conditions being given to all the countries with aid relief, or is this just Nicaragua?
This is the model across the board. Wherever this supposed debt relief is coming, it's coming with these conditions attached. In order to receive the debt relief, the countries will have to receive the approval of the International Monetary Fund, which will mean completing their so-called poverty reduction programs under the highly indebted poor countries program that the IMF started a few years ago. And that's going to mean cutting social services, privatizing public services, and putting their money into repaying their debt to private banks.
You're listening to Making Waves. We're talking with Sean Donohue today about his recent trip to Nicaragua and reflecting on some of the policies and world programs that have recently been discussed. Getting back to Scotland and the G8 summit, something going on at the same time was the Live 8 concert. What do you think about that?
I want to give people like Bono and Bob Geldof the benefit of the doubt and say that I think that they were acting out of compassion and trying to do something good. But what they were working on fundamentally lacked the analysis that was necessary to push for any kind of real change. Basically, they were operating out of a mindset of charity rather than a mindset of justice. Their idea was, here are these poor people in the southern part of the world, in Africa and Latin America, and we, the rich people in North America and Europe, ought to share some more of our resources with them. Lacking in that is any sort of question about how did we become rich and how did they become poor? The entire history of the looting of continents. When you look at the modern wealth of Europe, basically that came from Spain looting the gold from Latin America. Basically, that came from slave labor stolen from Africa, slave labor imposed through the genocide in the Americas, going back 500 years. And we continue to have those relationships. We continue, now we have multinational corporations that go in and take the resources out of these countries. Now we have factories that go in taking advantage of the poverty and unemployment in these countries to be able to force people to work 80-hour weeks, to be able to force people to work in inhuman conditions. And basically what happens when you have people like Bono and Bob Geldof getting up there and singing the praises of the leaders of the G8 and saying that these people are doing something to alleviate poverty is you have them undercutting the global movements for real economic justice. You have them putting this very public stamp of approval on these sham debt relief plans that then give the public the perception that something has changed when nothing really has. And so I think that really these people are unwittingly being used by those in power to make it look like real change is happening when in fact we're having more of the same.
What about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement? At the moment, that is passed the Senate and is being looked at in the House of Representatives. Can you give me your view on that piece of legislation?
The idea behind free trade is that there's supposed to be a level playing field between countries. For so many reasons, there's not a level playing field to begin with between the United States and the Central American countries, even before CAFTA goes through. And CAFTA, in fact, will tilt the scales more in favor of the U.S. while pretending to open up U.S. markets for Central American producers. In reality, what will happen is CAFTA will eliminate all the tariffs and all the restrictions that Central American countries currently have on U.S. goods in order to protect their own farmers. And none of those countries are in a position where they can afford to subsidize their farmers. Whereas in the U.S., we're paying very heavy subsidies to our farmers to grow more food than we need. At the same time, these farmers in the U.S. have access to credit and technology that can make them produce much more efficiently. and increasingly they're relying on genetically modified corn and wheat and soybeans in order to increase their harvests. So they're going to be put into a position where they're competing against poor farmers in Latin America who don't have the technology, who don't have the land, who don't have the subsidies. In Nicaragua, farmers haven't had credit for the past 15 years because when the Sandinista government lost power, one of the first things that was cut was the government loan programs for farmers. So farmers then had to go to private banks, where in many cases they couldn't get loans at all because they didn't have clear title to the land. And when they could get loans, they had to put up their land as collateral, face enormous interest rates, and when they didn't break even, ended up losing their land. And so they're already facing a crisis. What we're going to do now is we're going to force our products on their markets. We're going to dump cheap, mass-produced grain and corn and soybeans on these markets. That's going to wipe these farmers out. In addition to wiping the farmers out, it's going to wipe out the local crops. These are areas where there are native forms of grain, native forms of corn, native beans, native vegetables that are suited to the land. And we're going to be wiping those out altogether. In Nicaragua alone, it's estimated that 420,000 people are going to lose their jobs in the farming sector as a result of CAFTA. A number of things are going to happen as a result of that. The first is you're going to have people selling off their land. The small farmers who've tended to be good stewards of the land, who've allowed forests to grow back in many areas, who've allowed river streams to restore to their natural paths, who've been operating primarily organically, are going to lose their land. They're going to have to sell it off to foreign investors who are going to come in and reimpose plantation agriculture, which will deplete the soil, which will deplete the water, which will devastate the land. At the same time, you're going to have more and more poor people forced to leave their jobs and go into the cities looking for work. The Nicaraguan and the U.S. government say that the solution to the loss of jobs in the agricultural sector is going to be expansion of the textile industry. Well, to begin with, even according to their most optimistic estimates, we're talking about maybe 50,000 to 80,000 jobs being created in the textile industry. You have 420,000 people losing their jobs. Second grade math will tell you that's not going to be adequate. Secondly, this is an incredibly volatile sector. These textile companies are set up to be able to move out of the country in 48 hours if the wages drop lower and the working conditions change or the political climate changes. This is happening in an environment where China is now dropping its quota on textiles. So there's a flood in the world market. Prices are going to drop further. A lot of these companies are going to be moving to Asia anyway, so this isn't a viable source of development for Nicaragua or for any other Central American countries. Finally, we're going to have people who've been living in a rural existence where at least they have access to food, to water, in many areas to some medicinal herbs, who are going to be forced into an urban existence where they have no access to those basic needs and where poverty is going to be much more extreme. The government is losing revenue from tariffs, and so it's going to have to cut social services even further. We're going to see absolute devastation as hundreds of thousands of people pour into the cities looking for work that's not there, straining services that are already underfunded. And we're also going to see people increasingly leaving the country, going to Costa Rica, going to the U.S., looking for work. That's going to break apart families. And as that breaks apart families, there's going to be a tremendous social cost to pay. And so this is going to be absolutely devastating for Nicaragua.
I also understand that over the past few years, there has been ecotourism and growing of medicinal herbs and shade-grown organic coffee. That also would be threatened, it sounds like, if CAFTA is to take effect.
Absolutely. When the bottom fell out of the coffee market and farmers began going out of business in Nicaragua, a lot of the farmers' groups began to look for alternatives. They began to find that they could look towards running farms that would also serve as ecotourist centers so people could come in, be in this incredibly beautiful country, a country of rainforests, a country of volcanoes, a country of tremendous biodiversity, and enjoy the resources there. they began finding that the herbs that their ancestors had used had powerful medicinal properties, and those had a market both domestically and internationally. They began finding that organic agriculture could actually be carried out more effectively on a small scale than pesticide-intensive agriculture, and also didn't involve the same costs. They could then market their products to people in the U.S. and in Europe who were looking for organic coffee. But with CAFTA, it's going to be harder and harder for farmers who are beginning to diversify to hold on to their land, that the margin that they're surviving on is going to be lost. Many of them are going to lose their land. Meanwhile, as the farmers around them lose their land, as large-scale plantation agriculture moves in, possibilities for things like ecotourism, possibilities for cultivating medicinal herbs, possibilities even for organic agriculture are going to be lost as forests are cleared and as lakes and streams and rivers are increasingly polluted.
So, Sean, having just been in Nicaragua, what do the people there think about this? What is their reaction? What are they planning to do, and how are they planning to survive?
The people in Nicaragua are no strangers to struggle. I stayed with a family in the small town of El Regadillo. Augusto and Gloria both fought in the revolution. They both fought in the war against the Contras. And having seen war, they know the tremendous suffering that's involved. But they also say that they're ready to do whatever is necessary right now. Augusto says that at least when you're fighting a war with guns, you're not fighting on an empty stomach, that this economic war is a war of hunger. But they're not prepared to surrender. They've fought too hard for what they have. People in Nicaragua are beginning to rise up. There have been massive marches in the cities. There have been massive campaigns to pressure the Nicaraguan National Assembly. And recently, a coalition of unions and campesino groups and small business owners went to the National Assembly and gave them a deadline to reject CAFTA. Drawing from the example of the popular movements in Ecuador and Bolivia that succeeded in overthrowing their governments, they said that if the National Assembly doesn't reject CAFTA by the deadline they've set, they're going to blockade the roads through the country. They're going to shut down the Pan-American Highway, and that's going to bring Nicaragua to an economic standstill. Now, the military in Nicaragua is still largely in Sandinista control. That's a group of people who are going to tend to sympathize with the struggles of the poor, and who may very well end up refusing orders to try to break up these roadblocks. I think we may see a real situation of popular control coming in Nicaragua. And the bottom line is that, as I said, these are people who know how to struggle. Augusto said to me, "We fought a war at Aus Somoza. If we have to, we'll fight a war at Aus the corporations."
In June, early June, Donald Rumsfeld said that CAFTA is a national security issue. What do you think about that, Sean?
Well, it's very interesting. Increasingly, wherever people in Latin America have begun to stand up for their rights, the Bush administration has seen a vast conspiracy, accusing Cuba, Venezuela, and depending on the day and their mood, occasionally Brazil, of trying to foment revolution throughout the region. The ironic thing is that in a very different way than they understand, there's a degree of truth to what they're saying. The U.S. has tried twice unsuccessfully to launch coups against Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. In both cases, those coups were reversed by the people rising up. And the people of Venezuela, in that way, learned that their willingness to stand up on the streets, their willingness to put their lives on the line, was more powerful than any CIA-backed coup, and that they could render their country ungovernable in the face of foreign intervention. That lesson's been spreading through the region. Earlier in the spring, people of Ecuador rose up, shut down their country through blockades, and drove their president out of the country. Bolivia, for the second time in 3 years this June, saw indigenous people and coca farmers and union organizers band together, blockade the roads of their country, and drive another president out of power. Now people in Central America are being able to see that example. They're beginning to see that with the U.S. military tied up in Iraq and tied up in Afghanistan, the U.S. is no longer able to throw its weight around as much militarily as it was able to before. And so clearly the U.S. is worried about the spread, not of terrorism, but of democracy in the region, of people realizing their own power. We're now hearing that in Mexico next year, a populist that's likely to carry the election. So we're seeing a tide of democracy sweeping through Latin America, and that's terrifying to the U.S. Basically, when we hear about maintaining security, when we hear about maintaining order, we're hearing about maintaining the security of an economic order that keeps the poor down, that keeps the resources of poor countries feeding our oil addiction and our addiction to money in this country. We're looking at people cutting that off at its source, and that's tremendously frightening. And so in a very real sense, that is a threat to everything that people like Donald Rumsfeld would consider security.
And that's an incredibly optimistic thing to hear for those of us who are hoping for more democracy.
I think the tide of democracy in the Americas is really unstoppable now. People have begun to realize that if they aren't going to be afraid, if they aren't going to cooperate with those who issue orders to them, if they're not going to be intimidated by the power of the U.S. to the north, that they can accomplish anything. I think that once people have learned that, they're changed forever.
It's interesting because lately I've talked to activists who have been feeling very demoralized and very much like there's no hope and that the world is not savable anymore. And I think that even activists have not looked beyond our own borders so much and don't see this incredible amount of work and change happening in other parts of the world.
Absolutely. I think that even in activist circles, we still think of the U.S. as the center of the world. We still fail to understand what's really happening in other areas of the world. I think we fail to understand the real radical significance of this on so many levels, that when indigenous people in Bolivia rise up and blockade the roads, they're invoking the name of Pachamama, the earth goddess of the indigenous people of the land. And they're not just saying, we want this gas to bring profit for us, rather than for multinationals. They're saying, you can't take this gas from under Pachamama. You can't take away this land that we've lived on for centuries. You can't take away our sacred plants. This is the way we have always lived. This is the way we always will live. For 500 years, you couldn't crush us. You're not going to crush us now. Now, I think we're beginning to see the empire that has tried to crush these movements, these peoples, for so long, really reaching limits of its power. It's no longer able to stop them. And I think we're seeing the resurgence of indigenous power throughout the Americas. And that's a tremendously inspiring thing.
Well, that's a great note for us to end on, Sean. Again, I've been talking with Sean Donahue about his recent delegation to Nicaragua to look at the impact of economic U.S. policy in Nicaragua. We've been talking about the G8 and CAFTA and the people's movements springing up all over Central and South America. Thanks so much for coming in, Sean. And if you want to read Sean's writings, you can find him on the web at www.seandonahue.org. That's SEANDONAHUE.org. He is, as I mentioned earlier, a freelance journalist and poet, so he has some great stuff up there. Definitely want to check it out. So thanks again, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Yo no soy Inca capitán. Hace tiempo lo fui. Deje que vuelva para el sur. Déjeme ir allí. Deje que vuelva para el sur. Déjeme ir allí. Mi nombre casi lo olvidé. Dorotea Bazán. Yo no soy Inca, India soy por amor, capitán. Yo no soy Inca, India soy por amor, capitán. Me falta el aire pampa y el olor de los ranqueles campamentos, el cobre oscuro de la piel de mi señor en espejo de gramilla, cuero y sol. Usted se asombra, capitán, que me quiera volver. Un alarido de malón me reclama la piel. Un alarido de malón la piel. Yo me hice india y ahora estoy más cautiva que ayer. Quiero quedarme en el dolor de mi gente ranquel. Quiero quedarme en el dolor de mi gente ranquel. Me falta el aire pampa y el olor de los ranqueles campamentos, el cobre oscuro de la piel de mi señor en espejo de gramilla, cuero y sol. Quiero quedarme en el dolor de mi gente.
That was Mercedes Sosa with Dorotea La Cautiva. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show, or to let us know you want to help with the show, or to get that long website written out for you. Also, feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info. The number is 430-9722. That's 430-WSCA.